I'm very excited to be the one to introduce our speaker today. Don Richardson is a strong advocate for missions here in Canada and around the world. Don has a very special place in my heart. 30 years ago or more, he spoke at a fall conference at Peace River Bible Institute where I was attending. Through this and some special one-on-one time driving Don to and from the airport in Grand Prairie, and letters back and forth in years after that, God began to have a work in my heart and put world missions in my heart, which is still there today. Don is one of the leading modern-day missionaries, as well as an author of best-selling books like Peace Child, Lords of the Earth, and Eternity in Their Hearts. As a missionary in Irian Jaya for many years, God used Don and his wife Carol to turn a nation from cannibalism to Christianity. Don, I'm really excited, and we've already talked a little bit, to have you come to our church here at Cloverdale Baptist and share God's word. Come now.
Thank you for that illustrious introduction. If there are any exaggerations in what he said, may God forgive him. And may you forgive me for enjoying them. Speaking of introductions, what was the most important introduction in the history of mankind? Let's go back about 2,000 years. John the Baptist was privileged to introduce Jesus among the Jewish people as their promised Messiah, and more than that, as the Savior of the world. For the purpose of that most important ever introduction, John the Baptist employed what I consider to be the most meaningful metaphor ever used in any language. Pointing to Jesus of Nazareth that day, John the Baptist said, "Look, the Lamb of God, who does what? Say it with me, please. Who takes away the sin of the world." That metaphor, of course, was extremely meaningful among the Jewish people at that time. Why? For centuries, their ancestors had been sacrificing oxen, goats, sheep. An impoverished worshiper was even permitted to sacrifice an animal as small as a dove. To illustrate the need of an atonement for sin, an atonement whereby God, who is infinitely holy, could truly forgive people worthy of punishment without compromising his holiness in the act of forgiving the guilty. An atonement made that possible. It had to be an atonement that was acceptable to God. And those who sacrificed animals down through those centuries of the Old Testament era probably thought that it was that animal blood that was atoning for their sin. But does animal blood really atone for anyone's sin? We learn in the Epistle to the Hebrews, the blood of bulls and goats does not put away sin. But still, sacrificing those animals served as a foreshadowing of the one who would provide an atonement for the sin of the world. And those who sacrificed those animals in faith were, in effect, appropriating the benefit of that future sacrifice for themselves retroactively. So, sacrificing animals did serve a purpose, and I'm going to describe that purpose as a cultural compass. Now, we live in Canada. Canada is privileged to be the site of the world's North Magnetic Pole. And I delight in telling folks down south, whenever you lose the little arrow on a compass dial, which direction does it point? And some of them say north. I say, actually, that's not sufficiently precise. Not just north in the sense of the North Pole, but the Earth's North Magnetic Pole, which happens to lie within the borders of the land of my birth, Canada. And so, from any place on Earth, when someone loosens the arrow on the dial of a compass, that arrow points not to the North Pole, but to the North Magnetic Pole. And this is something that enables travelers, like sea captains, to find the right harbor, helps airline pilots to find the right airport, helps Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts to find their way back to camp in time for dinner after a hike in the woods. But there also are cultural compasses that God ordained to guide people to Jesus. And so animal sacrifice mentioned by John the Baptist as he introduced Jesus in John chapter 1, verse 29 is just one example. There are others. In John chapter 3, verse 14, Jesus drew a parallel to Nicodemus, saying, as Moses lifted up the serpent of brass in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. Now, that may have sounded rather mysterious to Nicodemus at that moment. But fast forward about 3 years, Nicodemus was an eyewitness of the crucifixion of our Lord. Imagine how forcefully that analogy must have come back to him when he saw Jesus lifted up on the cross. Then in John chapter 6, Jesus made mention of the provision of the manna for the children of Israel during their wilderness wanderings. And on that basis said, Moses gave you not the true bread from heaven. He went on to explain that true bread from heaven is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. And then Jesus said something that no one could say unless it's true, otherwise he'd be monumentally insane. He said, I am that bread of life. So John chapter 1, verse 29, John chapter 3, verse 14, and John chapter 6, beginning in verse 29. As you read on through the New Testament, you'll find many more examples of facets of Old Testament culture identified by New Testament authors as foreshadowing one aspect or another of redemption later to be provided in its fullness with the advent of our Lord. Especially in the Epistle to the Hebrews, the writer takes care to make sure we understand that features of the construction of the tabernacle in the wilderness and later of the temple in Jerusalem, aspects of the sacrifices and the selection of the priests, even the altar on which sacrifices were offered, were all foreshadowing one feature or another of redemption. Well, I'm sure you'll agree with me, fellow Christians, it was good of God to give the Jewish people all those special foreshadowings in their own cultural background. But now I invite you to ponder a major question with me. That question is, fine for them, but what about the rest of humanity? Did God take care to give only one small percentage of mankind foreshadowing to redemption and leave the vast majority of us down through history and around the world without that providence? Down through the centuries, those of us who have been trained to be frontier crossers with the gospel, encouraged to go out into regions of the world where the message had never been proclaimed, learn languages in which it had never been articulated, have not been encouraged to expect to find what might be called Gentile cultural compasses, distinct from Jewish cultural compasses, on the other side of frontiers all around the world. I guess those who instructed us as missionaries just didn't think God went to that much trouble. But in spite of the fact that our instructors did not tell us to expect to find such things, guess what we frontier crossers have been finding and exploiting down through the centuries, as the gospel has spread worldwide? Gentile cultural compasses. Would you like me to give you some examples? You really do? I just love it if people really want me to tell them what I really want to tell them. All right, I think you're asking for it. So I'm going to invite you to travel back in time with me. Are you willing to travel back in time for me, with me? Nod your head. You are? Good. You got to fasten your seatbelts. Let me hear the click. Good. On the count of three. One, two, three. It's 1807. Where are we? Look, look, we're standing by the docks in the port city of China. Here's a ship flying a British flag. There's one lone Britisher disembarking. Who is he? Robert Morrison. Why is Robert Morrison setting foot in China in 1807? Really? He's here to be a Christian missionary? How strange. Doesn't he know there are already four other ancient religions entrenched in China? Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, and in some areas of China, even Islam is already established. What chance does one man have to think he can establish a foothold for Christianity in China against such odds? Well, looks like he's game to the challenge, ready to face the task, or is he? I think he looks a little discouraged. Robert Morrison has just found out that the ancestors of the Chinese, 40 centuries earlier, did not sit down and invent a phonetic alphabet of 26 or so symbols like our A to Z. They wanted something more complex. They got it. They invented a writing system that utilizes more than 200 little pictures called radicals that get combined in complex ways to make Chinese words. Imagine Robert Morrison taking one look at Chinese writing, shaking his head in dismay, and saying, "This reminds me of chicken tracks in the mud." He may have been tempted to complain just a little bit to God, saying, "Lord, where were you when they invented this? Couldn't you have exercised your marvelous capacity for sovereignty just a little more to cause them to come up with something simpler than this?" But he had no choice. He had to master that extremely complex writing system. Robert found a Chinese man who had some knowledge of English and was willing to use his minimal knowledge of English to help Robert Morrison crack the code of Chinese grammar and amass vocabulary in the language. Sitting down one morning with that Chinese language helper, Robert gave the man his pen and said, "Please, please, take my pen and show me. Which of these more than 200 little radicals do you combine to form the word that means righteousness in Chinese?" The Chinese man took Robert's pen and went swish, 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 swish on a piece of paper and showed him this. The part colored red here is the Chinese symbol for a lamb. The part colored white is the Chinese symbol for I, first person, singular pronoun. When the Chinese write the word that means righteous, they're actually writing the lamb over me, righteous. The same metaphor that John the Baptist had used to introduce Jesus among the Jewish people was there and had been there for 40 centuries in the Chinese writing system. Robert was rather startled to see that. Of course, he asked his Chinese language helper, "Sir, do you know about the lamb under whom you and I must be found to be righteous in the sight of Shangti, the Lord of Heaven?" Shangti, the Chinese name for God. Chinese language helper said, "No, I don't know about that lamb. How about you, foreigner, do you know?" Enabling Robert to say to him, "Oh, do I have good news for you and for your people?" And Robert said to himself, "If there's one spiritually significant encoded message in this ancient writing system, there may be other things awaiting discovery here." So he was just filled with a sense of challenge and adventure as he went on to discover more than 120 Chinese words that had spiritually significant messages implicit according to how the ancestors of the Chinese people themselves had decided to combine little pictures instead of phonetic symbols to make words. Robert found the Chinese word for a ship requires you to draw something resembling the shape of the hull of a ship. But it doesn't mean ship until you specify further information. You have to indicate the precise number of people who are sailing in the ship. If you write any other number than the one I'm about to mention, you will lose one mark in a Chinese language exam. And what is the number? 8 people sailing in the ship. Why 8 people? Why do you suppose they thought that 8 people was somehow significant sailing in a ship? According to Genesis, what was the first ship that ever floated? How many people were delivered from the flood in the ark? 8 personas, 8 people in a ship. And Robert found the Chinese word for covet, desiring something that doesn't belong to you, belongs to someone else, and you're coveting it. The word for that requires you to draw 2 trees and then draw a symbol for a woman making some kind of a choice between 2 trees. Now, what could that possibly have to do with coveting? And the Chinese word for the verb come is more complex. To begin, you have to draw the symbol for a tree at the center. And the symbol for a tree is a tree shaped like a cross. Now, the Chinese symbol for a man is like our letter Y turned upside down. Guess what you have to draw right over the center of the cross-shaped tree, an upside down Y, a man suspended on a tree. Then you draw another part of it, which means mankind. And now you have the word for come. It reads like an encoded message. Mankind come to the man who was hung on the tree. Robert Morrison must have said, "Lord, I take it back. I think your sovereignty was manifested. You guided the hand of the ancestors of the Chinese people to provide all of these eye-openers for me, and he realized he could use them, and he did so. As he learned the Chinese language, he began to proclaim Jesus as the reality foreshadowed. He was privileged to loosen little arrows on 120 uniquely Chinese cultural compasses. Now, he really needed that help because European colonial powers had done some very devious things in China, and the Chinese people were filled with resentment against Europeans at that time. They called Europeans foreign devils. And Robert Morrison was identified as a foreign devil, but he overcame that as he was utilizing things that the ancestors of the Chinese people had decided to use, showing them as foreshadowing the message he was bringing to China, a message destined to be received there as the fulfillment of all those things the ancestors had somehow foreshadowed. Well, people began to turn to the Lord in China. Robert wrote letters to supporting churches back in the United Kingdom. And as his letters were being read in front of congregations of Christians, people were amazed and began to respond saying, "That's amazing what is happening out in China." Then people began to say, "Robert Morrison, is he the only one we sent out there? Is he all alone?" And the elders who commissioned him to go to China rather sheepishly said, "Yes, he's the only one we sent." And he was, if he hadn't twisted our arms, we probably wouldn't have sent him, but he just kept insisting. So he said, okay, we'll let you go. Apparently it is worthwhile. So people began to say, "Are there others willing to follow the trail that he has blazed?" There were others willing to go. Another was a Canadian named Jonathan Goforth and Hudson Taylor and Maria. And soon there were 1,000 or so proclaiming the gospel across the length and breadth of China and beginning to draw more and more Chinese people to faith in Jesus, the Lamb, under whom we become righteous in the sight of Shangdi, the Lord of Heaven, until there were estimated to be, in the mid-1940s, 1 million Christians in China. Some of the Christians would have been Christian in demographic sense only, but at least they would claim to be Christians. But a large majority of them were true believers. And late 1940s, the communists took control of China and began to oppress every religious system in China, including Christianity. They're believed to have slaughtered 500,000 Christians within the first few years of the communist takeover of China, reducing the number of professing Christians by half. And then they began imposing restrictions upon the surviving Christians, warning them, "Unless you abandon your commitment to Christianity, you cannot be employed by the government, you cannot be a teacher in any school, and your children cannot receive public education. If you insist on remaining a Christian, you can do nothing more than be a grave digger, a garbage collector, or a tiller of the fields in the communes." Because of these restrictions, it is estimated another 200,000 Christians capitulated to the pressure of the communists and gave up. So now the number of Christians was reduced not just from 1 million to 500,000, but from 500,000 to about 300,000. And then the communists, knowing they were there, appointed a committee to decide how can we weaken the faith of the remaining 300,000 Christians without the expense of imprisoning them and having to feed them and bury them if they die. And someone in the committee offered a suggestion. He said, "I've studied Christianity and I know where it has a weakness." He said, "Christianity is a religion which depends upon its adherents getting together frequently for Christian meetings. So only as they meet together and sing hymns together and pray together and quote scriptures together that their faith is mutually strengthened. So we have a simple solution. We'll send out an order that if more than one Christian or more than one nuclear family of Christians are found in any one commune, we'll leave just that one unit there, scatter the others to other communes where there are no Christians. Then Christians will not be able to find other Christians to have meetings with. In the absence of Christian meetings, their faith will steadily diminish and eventually weaken and die." "Thank you," said the other members of the committee. "We would not have thought of an ingenious solution like that." So the order went out, scatter the Christians as thinly as possible throughout the entire commune system. As a result, the communist government of China, at its own expense, unwittingly became the most efficient missionary sending organization in 2,000 years of church history. Because the 300,000 Christians, they scattered like seeds into the commune system, began to lead more and more Chinese people to faith. They manifested joy despite threats against their well-being by their own government. And they were noted for honesty, integrity, and compassion. And so more and more people were drawn to faith through them. And the number of Christians in China began to grow exponentially. To the dismay of the Chinese Communist government, there are now more than 100 million Christians in China who are professing that faith despite threats against their well-being. And the number of Christians in China is believed to be growing, increasing at an average of 1 million more Christians a month. Even some secular scholars are beginning to write academic papers about what they call the Christianization of Communist China. Was the kingdom of God poised and ready to advance when Robert Morrison blazed that trail? It was indeed. Think of how important it was, how much glory for God was waiting to be manifested through a man willing to obey. So did God prepare the gospel for China? Yes. And did he prepare the Chinese people to be capable of hearing the ring of truth in the gospel? There was a prior preparation in terms of things in the Chinese culture waiting to be utilized to help make the meaning of the gospel clear. All right, that jump back in time didn't jar your bones too much, did it? Willing to go a little further back? Keep the seat belts fastened. 1, 2, 3, it's 1792. We're in India, the world's second most populous nation. William Carey and his wife Dorothy are unpacking, setting up housekeeping in the midst of hundreds of millions of Hindus in India. They're experiencing culture shock, believe me. Hadn't been in India very long before they heard a woman screaming out in the street. William rushed out to see if she needed rescuing, and she did. But he was unable to rescue her because her own family, her own relatives, were binding her, dragging her, and laying her on a pile of firewood beside the body of her husband who had died. The Careys were encountering a Hindu custom called sati, which meant when a Hindu man died, his widow had to be burned alive with his body. It didn't matter if she was decades younger than her deceased husband or the mother of little children who needed her to nurse them. The priority was to show respect for her departed husband by being burned alive with his body. William tried to rescue the widow. He failed. And he complained to the British colonial authorities of the British East India Company, who were in control of India at the time, saying, "You have the power to make this cruel Hindu custom illegal. Why haven't you done it?" And they said, "Don't bother us about things like that. It's not our concern. Our priority is to sustain a steady cash flow of profits for the mother country. That's all that matters to us, Mr. Carey." And they warned, "If you dare preach against Hindu customs like sati and anger them so they refuse to work for us, that will interrupt our cash flow and we will put you in jail, sir." Appalled at the callousness of his fellow Britishers who couldn't care less about something so cruel, William shared his problem with some Danish friends of his in a Danish enclave on the coast of India called Serampore. He said, "What am I going to do? I feel like I have to preach against things like sati, as well as idol worship, things that are opposite of biblical ethics. But if I do and the Hindus get angry and complain, they'll throw me in jail and that's the end of my ministry." The Danes said to him, "William, don't worry about that. We can solve this problem for you." "Really," he said, "what can you Danes do to solve my problem with my fellow Britishers?" "That is very simple. Great Britain and Denmark have a treaty, so we're going to make you a citizen of Denmark, William Carey. We're going to give you a Danish passport. You go ahead and preach whatever you think God wants you to preach, and if the Brits come to arrest you, wave your Danish passport in their faces. It'll be a perfect shield." It worked. I hope that God has somehow rewarded little Denmark for the encouragement his reps out there in India gave to a beleaguered William Carey back in the 1790s. And so the British soldiers went throughout India. They saw some Hindus getting ready to burn a widow alive. They would say, "We forbid you to do that." And the Hindus would say, "But it's our culture to do that." "Yes, we know it's your culture, but it's our culture to hang men who do that by the neck until dead. So if you do what your culture requires, we'll do what our culture requires, and you'll get the worst of it." So we can be sure, tens of millions of women in India owe the extension of their lives beyond the death of their husbands to the goodness of God at last reaching India in this special way through William Carey. And there was also the problem of the world's most massive system of racist apartheid. I'm not talking about South Africa, but Something in India that gets away with not being identified as racist apartheid is called caste. Just because it has a different name, it gets away without disapproval. The world has a double standard, justifiably opposing racist apartheid in South Africa, but ignoring a massively greater system of the same thing in Hindu North India. Caste means that the original inhabitants of India, people of the Dravidian race, were conquered by the Aryan race, and the Aryan conquerors set themselves up as high caste Hindus, relegating the Dravidian population to be the low caste, and the lowest of the low are the untouchables. Hindu priests warn people called Dalits, the untouchable, you can be punished if you even accidentally touch the skin of a high caste Aryan person. They could even be punished if they allowed the sun to cast their shadow upon the person of a high caste Aryan. So, Dalits in India are warned by Hindu priests. They are virtually subhuman scum. And so William Carey and those who follow the trail he blazed to India were saying, oh God, where can we find anything in this cultural context that would help us to explain the Christian message to both Aryans of the high caste and Dravidians of the low caste Hindu population? Well, William Carey was a marvelous linguist, and as he learned language after language in India, he realized there was a language called Sanskrit, which is to India as Latin is to our Western civilization. Nobody speaks Latin anymore, but scholars study it, learn to read it, because there's such an important body of literature preserved in Latin. I studied Latin for 2 years in high school in Victoria, B.C. We used to sing a little song, Latin is a language as dead can be. First it killed the Romans, and now it's killing me. But I actually enjoyed it. So William Carey thought, why should I learn Sanskrit? Because I can't use it to preach the gospel, except for a few scholars. And they already know other languages anyway. But he decided to study Sanskrit, and he was glad he did. That enabled him to read a body of ancient literature called the Vedas. And the oldest Vedic writings were written 3,500 or more years earlier. Now, in the more recent Vedic literature, recent meaning 2,000 years older, you see the proliferation of idolatry and the caste system and burning widows alive and other things. But as William began to peruse the ancient Vedic literature, things that were oldest, he found that they were manifesting a higher moral ethic than the later writings. And he found things that read like prophecies. Really amazing. For example, he found an ancient text in the Vedas which said, somewhere in the world there's an upside-down tree. Now, what can cause a tree to be upside-down besides a tornado, hurricane, or a bulldozer? This is a tree that is upside-down because it is rooted in heaven. And it goes down toward the earth instead of up from the earth. It spreads its branches out above the earth in every possible direction, yielding nourishing fruit for all mankind. It goes on to say that the trunk of the upside-down tree will be gashed, and the sap that bleeds from the wound in the side of the upside-down tree is for the healing of mankind. Nourishing fruit from the branches, healing sap from a wound in the side of a tree rooted in heaven. Now, does that sound like a very strange metaphor, if you ever heard one? Despite its strangeness, does it remind you of someone? No one but Jesus can be offered to Hindus in Nepal or in India or in a 7-Eleven near you or a Hindu doctor that may heal you when you're sick. No one but Jesus can be offered. So, these things were found in the ancient Vedas and missionaries began to use them. And so, more and more people in India are responding to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And where do you suppose the greatest response would be in India? From the Aryan Hindus on their high caste pedestal of privilege or from the Dalits, especially the untouchables, the lowest of the low? The greatest response is coming from the Dalits. They're learning through the gospel of Jesus Christ that they are created in whose image? They're created in the image of God. And who cared enough for them to die to atone for their sin? God incarnate in the person of Jesus Christ. Does that sound like good news to men and women who have been told by Hindu priests that they are virtually subhuman scum, unworthy to be touched by a real human being? It is indeed. I've heard that an average of about 300 new house churches are opening the doors for the first time, forming around the length and breadth of India. But every now and then, a high-caste Aryan Hindu also believes in Jesus. And what does that mean for him or her? That high-caste Aryan who becomes a believer in Jesus Christ tumbles down the social scale of the caste system even lower than the untouchables, being regarded as an outcast. So, China and India. Preparation for the gospel and people responding in terms of things that are part of their own cultural background that opens their mind to the message of salvation found in the Hebrew and Old Testament and the Greek New Testament inspired by God. But what about Stone Age tribes hidden away in remote jungles? They couldn't be found to have anything significant like that in their cultural background. What if they're cannibals and headhunters? They eat human flesh and cut off human skulls and save them as trophies. Surely they would not have anything that could be identified as pointing them to Jesus, could they? Or could they? Please show us a map. That's the map of a dinosaur-shaped island, about 2,500 kilometers long, north of Australia, just below the equator. See the head of the dinosaur at the left end, the tail of the dinosaur on the eastern side. That is New Guinea, the other side of the Pacific Ocean, and there's 1,000 tribes speaking 1,000 languages, and some of the tribes in New Guinea are cannibals that eat human flesh and cut off heads and save skulls as trophies. Back in 1962, my wife Carol Joy, who is not the Carol who's with me now. Carol, please stand up. This is my wife, Carol Joyce. My first wife was Carol Joy. Carol Joy, Carol Joyce. It was like a sign from God. Pay attention to this woman. But Carol Joy, with our firstborn son, baby Stephen, next slide, flew across the Pacific in 1962 and found ourselves commissioned under a mission called World Team. Please, everyone, say out loud, World Team. Now say worldteam.org. Look us up on the web. World Team began back in the 1870s in London, England, and has spread around the world, crossing new frontiers. And Carol and I were privileged to be World Team's ambassadors to one of the 1,000 tribes in New Guinea, a tribe called the Sawi, about 3,000 people who had never been approached by anyone in the outside world. And they lived in tree houses, next slide, 40 to 50 feet above the ground. Why do they live that high above the ground? Well, if enemies attack, guess where the women and children are? High above the battle. And if an enemy gets behind the lines of defense and tries to climb up one of those long ladders, the women, they're going to do their best to protect their babies. They're going to throw things at him and hit him on the head or cut the ladder so he falls to his ground. So if you're sleeping up there at night, there's fewer mosquitoes. And if enemies are trying to encroach through the bushes, you have a better chance of seeing them. So tree houses serve a purpose in the jungles of New Guinea for a tribe like the Sawi. So Carol and I with Stephen, next slide, lived in a little house like this one. I built it with the help of the Sawi. It was just 6 meters by 6 meters with a thatch roof. It looked like a little matchbox below the towering jungle trees. Because it resembled a matchbox and had a thatch roof, I nicknamed it our thatch box. And why did the Sawi help me build that? Because before I showed up, they'd begun to hear positive reports about unusually tall, unusually pale, sickly-looking people called Tuans. That means European types. And all the reports about us Europeans were positive reports, thank God. Europeans, Tuans as they called us, were noted for bringing medicine to heal the sick and steel tools to replace stone tools, and fish line and fish hooks, and something utterly amazing called soap. If imagine you're 40 years old and soap has never touched your skin. You've bathed in the river, but just water without soap does not remove the pig grease, does not remove the soot from the fire you've been sleeping next to. So the first time you bathe with soap, the feeling of total cleanliness is addicting. And everybody wants soap. And salt was an amazing thing that they also required. So because of all the reports about Tuan, we never hurt anyone, and we always bring these wonderful helps. The Sawi tribe had begun to ask other tribes living a little closer to civilization, saying, hey, are there any spare Tuans around? We think we'd like to welcome one. Only had the other tribe say in a nasty way, nope, Tuans are a rare commodity, not enough for every tribe to have one, and they're choosy about where they live and who they live among, and you Sawi are the worst of all the tribes. Don't get your hopes up. You'll never be favored by the presence of one of these rare beings. Hearing these insults from other tribes, the Sawi people were saying wistfully, perhaps they're right, I guess we can't claim to be anyone special, but they also said just as wistfully, just in case someday, somewhere, there is a Tuan who finds out that we Sawi live here, and he chooses to come and reside among us, and if he does not allow the anti-Sawi propaganda of our enemies to turn him away from us, when we find out that Tuan has chosen us, we'll let him know and know in certain terms we choose him. He'll be our Tuan. We'll be his tribe. Well, guess which sort of a bloke you're looking at here. I'm a Tuan. My wife, Carol Joy Anyonya, a female Tuan. Even had a little baby Tuan, little Stephen, less than a year old. So they welcomed us by dancing around us almost nonstop for 3 days and three nights and helped us build that little house. And I had to learn their language. Do you suppose I could go to a bookstore and buy a published grammar and a published dictionary for the Sawi language? A language that never even had an alphabet invented for it. And do you suppose there was at least one Sawi who spoke some English and could help me learn Sawi the way that Chinese man helped Robert Morrison learn Chinese? No. How do you learn a language in a situation like that? You have to resort to the finger-pointing method. So I began by pointing at things, hoping that people would give me a Sawi word for whatever I pointed at. I pointed at a man, and they said, Ridig. I pointed at a woman, and they said, Ridig. I pointed at a dog, a fish, a canoe, a paddle. No matter what I pointed at, they kept saying, Ridig, 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 Ridig. But then I was saying, Lord, have you led us halfway around the world to learn a language that has only one word? Then I realized, Ridig meant finger. Because they do not point with one finger, they point with their lips. So pointing with my lips instead of with a finger, I began to accumulate more and more Sawi nouns, and I mimicked actions to get verbs like walking forward, backwards, sideways, sitting down, lying down, sitting up, standing up, throwing, catching, looking, listening, sleeping, waking, sleeping, and eating, drinking, smiling, frowning. You name it, I mimicked it, got the verbs. And I began to get adjectives and adverbs and conjunctions. I felt like a linguistic Columbus sailing an uncharted linguistic sea. And I just enjoyed it. It was such a challenge, and it was just so incredibly exciting. And when I learned the language well enough, as I traveled from one village to another by dugout canoe, I would ask the elders in each village, who, according to your traditions, created everything, the sun, the moon, the stars, the world, and all the people and animals? In village after village, they said, we don't know, we forgot his name. That enabled me to say, guess why I have come to live among you. Really? Is it because you know the name of the creator of everything? I said, yes, I know his name and much more than just his name. So they were quite amazed that it wasn't just to bring steel axes and machete and salt and soap and other things that they'd never heard of before but really wanted. There was a higher and grander reason than that. And eventually I learned the language well enough to begin telling them about Jesus, describing creation. God created mankind in his image to enjoy fellowship, be worshipped by the peak of his creation. But sin happened, and the estrangement occurred. Mankind was lost, and a solution was needed. God sent Jesus into the world as a human being to provide redemption. He grew up among the Jewish people, chose his disciples, working miracles, teaching crowds of people. Then one of his disciples, Judas, turned against him and betrayed him with a kiss of friendship to be led away and slain. To my shock and chagrin, when I described Judas's use of a kiss of friendship to consummate his betrayal of his victim, they burst forth cheering for Judas, exclaiming, Ton, that man named Judas is the sort of man we call a Tane Duan, a master of treachery. Tell us more about him. Someone else chimed in. He actually used a kiss of friendship to finish his betrayal. That's what we call Tui Asanaiman, using gestures of friendship merely to fatten a victim for an unsuspected slaughter. Believe me, these were not the responses I was expecting. I was chilled to the bone in spite of the tropical heat. And I prayed and said, Lord, Lord, help, I need a gift of wisdom here. They misunderstand. They think Judas is the hero of the story. How can I possibly help them to see that it isn't Judas, but Jesus? You know what the Bible says, if any man lack wisdom, let him take a further course in seminary. What does it hurt? First and foremost, ask of God. And believe me, I was asking and asking of God. But what sort of a solution could God provide? What sort of gift of wisdom could exist? Believe me, I was feeling wistfully envious of Robert Morrison in China, with more than 100 Chinese words ready for him to utilize as Chinese cultural compasses. The Sawi had nothing like that. They didn't even have an alphabet at all, let alone a complex writing system like Chinese. So, I was up against it. And then, because three villages, that each of whom used to live miles apart, decided all three wanted to live next door to us, because my wife, Carol, a registered nurse, was using medicine to save lives. She probably saved an average of a life a day, treating people for malaria and hepatitis and dysentery and other tropical diseases whose names you probably wouldn't even know. And they called her the woman that makes all the villages well. So three villages wanted to live close to us, and we were glad to welcome them, because that was that many more people to help us learn the language, that many more people we could preach the gospel to directly once I had sufficient fluency in the language. But there was a problem. Two of those villages had been at war with each other prior to the relocation, whereas they used to live miles apart and therefore fought each other infrequently. Now they were living next door to each other, and they began to fight almost daily. Arrows were flying, and people were being wounded right outside our door. And I would stand on the edge of these raging battles, pleading, please make peace, please stop trying to kill each other. And some days I had a measure of success in interrupting the momentum of the battles, but then another day, their hatred of each other would boil over, and there'd be another battle. And we were using up a lot of medicine, treating people who got in need by choosing to fight and kill and be wounded. And that left us with less medicine for people who got sick through no fault of their own. The Dutch government was still there, was a colony at the time. And the Dutch government said, we're not willing to send our Dutch doctors and nurses out into these wild areas where you missionaries are willing to go, but the least we can do is give you the medicine you for sure will need out there. So we had these medicines, and we're saving lives with them. But then I said, if you cannot bring this violence to an end, I'm simply going to have to move away from this cluster of three villages, build another little thatch box like that one with the help of people in another Sawi village, so that these villages that are unable to live in close proximity without trying to kill each other will go back where they were before, and let the distance between their communities be one kind of enforcer of some degree of peace. My announcement that I was planning on moving away if the violence did not cease got their attention. Now, they had been saying in response to my pleading for peace, you keep asking us to make peace, Don, as if that should be an easy thing to do. And that's probably because you two ones never war with each other, right? So you don't understand that making peace is a difficult thing. They thought we were, you know, utterly peaceful, all of us. They didn't know the war in South Vietnam was raging at that very time. So they said, making peace is not the easy thing you seem to think it should be. You don't realize what you're asking. And when I found out about the idealization of treachery, I thought, that's probably what they're referring to, because of the preference for being specialists in betrayal, they can't trust each other. So this is a culture devoid of any mechanism for making peace. I was to discover that's not what they meant. Yes, treachery was there. Yes, treachery made it difficult, but didn't make it impossible to make peace. I was to discover, by threatening to move away if the violence did not cease, that they did have a way of establishing a true and lasting peace. But it was costly. extremely costly. If a father genuinely wanted to make peace, he could do so only if he was willing to make a sacrifice so great that everybody would know. A man motivated by insincerity would stop short of making that great a sacrifice. This would be a sacrifice which would be a proof of genuine sincerity, even in a context of specialized treachery. He had to be willing to take one of his own little baby sons and give his infant son as a peace child to a father in the enemy village. And at sunrise the next morning, a father in one of those two warring villages, a man named Cayo, asked the fathers in his village that he knew were blessed with more than one child each if they were willing to make the sacrifice so the two on the Nyonya would not move away. One father after another said, "No, I cannot bring myself to give a child. I love my children too much." So Kyle said, "Well, I love my child too, but I cannot bear to see the senseless violence of my people drive the two on the Nyonya away. The bringers of blessing must be welcomed here." And so he knew he was about to break his wife's heart. He and his wife had been married for years and were blessed with only one baby. He knew he could not wait for her consent. She couldn't possibly consent. Her maternal instinct would have been far too strong. He could hardly summon the will himself, but he knew it was necessary for the greater good of the many. He and his wife had to suffer an agony of loss. He picked up his little baby son after his wife left the manhouse unsuspecting, hugged his little baby boy one last time, climbed down from his longhouse with Byakadon in his arms, and ran with that baby named Byakadon out of his village, past our home, into the enemy village with no weapons to defend himself. And I thought, he's weaponless and no reinforcements. What if they take advantage of him and kill him and the baby? I asked a Sawi man, "Are they in any danger?" He said, "No, no. Didn't anyone tell you, Don? We Sawi never kill a man who approaches us with a child in his arms." I thought, "Really?" And then I remember, what was I holding in my arms when we arrived by dugout canoe 6 months before? My baby son, Stephen, the first of our four children. If they had intended to kill us that evening, the fact that we arrived with a baby would have saved our lives. Well, they were genuinely welcoming us, but Kyle carried his son in his arms, not for his own protection among enemies, but for a grander purpose, to make enemies friends. He chose an enemy father named Mahor and placed his only son in that man's arms and said to him, "Mahor, no koni no somedap, go kefinigade taromakumai. Mahor, I give my son, my only son, to you as a peace child." Mahor, amazed that the baby son he held in his arms was another father's only child, realized in living memory that had never happened before. Whenever a peace child had been given, always been given by a father blessed with more than one child. But Kayo gave an only son. And Mahor said, "Kayo, gunigo somai dapniki kepina rende es. Kayo, you've given an only son to us. This is such a great sacrifice. We are reconciled. It is enough." And he began to present that little baby boy to all the people of the village, and I saw them forming a long line, filing past, reaching out a hand, touching the little Byakadon on the chest, and saying, "This child I receive as a basis for peace." And everyone refused to touch the offered son. No one refused a father's incredible sacrifice. Then a man from that village, deeply moved by Kayo's sacrifice of an only son, reciprocated by giving one of his several children to Kayo, that Kayo might at least have another woman's offspring to place in his the arms of his wife, who was wailing pitifully. And the peace was made, and they celebrated peace tumultuously for 3 days and three nights. And I stood there as the celebration was getting underway, saying to myself, "What is this? A father giving a son, an only son at that, to his enemies to achieve reconciliation? Why is there something familiar about this?" It hit me. I gasped in amazement and said, "Oh my God, look what you had prepared. You foresaw my need, and their need. You provided this. You overruled in the formation of this unique human culture. You knew all the evil things the evil one would give them, but you guaranteed there would be at least this that has your fingerprints on it, this that is ready to point them to Jesus as the perfect personal fulfiller of something extremely meaningful to them. It took me 3 months of intensive language study to find all the right nouns and verbs. Then I began proclaiming Jesus as the Tarab Timkodon, the greatest peace child given by Nabokodon, the greatest father, to establish the Tokon Akodon, the greatest peace between God and man, between man and his fellow man. Well, they listened with increasing interest. I was making so much more sense among them from that time forward than I had made before. They began responding with perceptive questions, including this one. Don, are you sure that Jesus is really a peace child? I said, yes, the absolute true one. They said, well, that conflicts with something you told us about him earlier. I said, really? What was that? They said, didn't you tell us that someone named Judas betrayed him with a kiss to be killed? I said, yes, I did. And I was horrified that you acclaimed the betrayer as the hero. They said, wait a minute, sir. You did not tell us that he betrayed a peace child with that kiss. Now, did you? No. Don't you see, if you told us that, it would have made all the difference in the world. To betray a peace child would be the most evil thing anyone could possibly do. You didn't tell us about that until now. So believe me, Judas's ratings plunged. And Jesus was uplifted among them as the perfect personal fulfiller of their Sawi peace child ideal. Day came when a one-eyed Sawi chief named Hato, he'd lost one eye in a battle, an arrow had pierced his eye, lost the sight of that eye. But Hato's one good eye was glowing like a lamp turned on as he stood up after he listened to me trace the parallels between Kayo's gift of little Byakadon and God's gift of Jesus. He said, Don, goni sin pakegu no hawahadadon kakein. Don, your words make my liver quiver. I said, why, Hato, my friend, why? I've been listening to everything you've been telling us about the great peace child named Jesus, and I, Hato, am ready to lay my hand upon him, kadon mani, by way of faith, as you said. Please tell me, what shall I say to him? I want Jesus and the Father gave him to know that I, Hato, am receiving him by way of faith. I led him in prayer. He repeated the words after me, inviting the Spirit of God's Holy Peace Child Jesus to dwell within his liver, keep him in the way of peace with God and men from the inside. Yes, for the Sawi, the liver is the main thing. The heart is only a pump. And believe me, as cannibals, they know about the internal organs. So Hato was at peace with God. And soon there were others coming, and an incredible transformation began to blossom. I would love to tell you, I could love to keep you here till 4 o'clock this afternoon and tell you more about the response of the Sawi people and about these redemptive analogies, as I call them, cultural compasses that I found in dozens of cultures. But if you want to know more about the Sawi, what happens after that amazing breakthrough began back in 1963, you will find a book called Peace Child or a DVD by the same name, a DVD, a movie in which 1,000 Sawi men, women, and children are reenacting the story I told you. No Hollywood actors, just the Sawi and Carol and me, as we looked years ago. You won't recognize me. I look rather different now. But I was there in that film. And 2 years ago in June of 2012 was the 50th anniversary of our initial entrance to the Sawi with our baby son, Stephen. Stephen and his three younger brothers joined me in June of 2012 to go back to the Sawi to celebrate the 50th anniversary, and the four of us were welcomed. I should have said three sons, not four. Me and three sons. The four of us were welcomed by 2,000 believers from 37 villages, and a fair percentage of the 2,000 people were non-Sawi from four neighboring tribes that the Sawi had been evangelizing. I gave them the New Testament in their own language, taught them to read it, and other missionaries replaced us when we came home in 1977. So the Sawi tribe was flourishing, and in that welcome, I was privileged to join 24 Sawi pastors in baptizing 315 new believers and a mass wedding with 102 couples who wanted to be married or to reaffirm their vows with a second wedding, and a mass dedication of 130 new babies. To experience that with my three sons, can you imagine? I felt like I was walking on air. The joy was so intense. So there's that story, but I went on to search library research and interviewing missionaries and even reading books by secular anthropologists and began to discover dozens of things that serve the same purpose in dozens of different cultures around the world. So after I wrote Peace Child about our personal experience and produced the movie Peace Child, I went on to write Lords of the Earth about a tribe in the mountains that killed and cannibalized two of my fellow world team colleagues. And then we found after that tragedy, that tribe had places of refuge. Jesus was waiting to be introduced to them as the Osawa Ovalam, the true place of refuge. We didn't find out about it in those early days. And then I found tribes that have a symbolic new birth as a way of making peace. Can you imagine? They're better prepared to be reasoned with about new birth than Nicodemus was. Yes, how astonishing. God has surprises awaiting us out there in the world. If we're willing to follow his leading, cross a new frontier, you find that the God has prepared you to be his witness to them and prepared the message for you to take to them is also the one who's prepared them to be able to grasp the significance of the message. So this is missions. Notice the fourth word up there. Truth, love, holiness, and say it, mission. Is God's mission a glorious thing? Is it a delightful thing? Has God ingeniously prepared for the fulfillment of blessing all peoples on earth through people like us? So ask God, what part does he have for you to play? Each of us can be a part of that ongoing mission, directly or indirectly. Well, my wife Carol will be there at our book and DVD display. Oh, and by the way, I'm an artist, and I have begun painting pictures of the mountain tribes and the lowland tribes so that people might understand just what it looks like, and can under each picture is like a story of something happening that's important to the people and which is important for a missionary to understand. So I just have to stop. I mean, I could keep on going. You realize that, don't you? But honoring your culture, amen. Thank you, Pastor.